outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Journey. The God Journey.
So we are navigating kind of an interesting space right now, Jess and I are. We are walking through the nostalgia of selling our first family home. And it's been very mixed, Wayne. It's been a very mixed experience. This is the space that Jess and I, first home that Jess and I ever purchased. This is where both of our daughters were born. We brought them home here. And the idea of closing up shop and passing it on to somebody else is, man, it elicits all kinds of emotions. I don't know what your experience was like when you sold your first home that you and Sarah were in, or if you had like a major family home that had a lot of memories for you, but this has been an interesting one.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. No, we've sold a lot of homes. We've moved our kids around like they were, you know, jackrabbits or something. So their childhood home, it wasn't hard to sell that. We were done, but they'd gone to college. So they'd gotten out of the house and I loved the property, but Sarah was ready to have less space. And then we ended up with more space after a couple of homes. And then now we're back to less space. But
do you have any specific home or any memories tied to homes? Like for you, is a home meaningful to you, or is it more just a thing?
I think it's become more than just a thing. You know, looking back, growing up on the ranch, it was hard when my folks sold the ranch because we grew up there, took the kids there. But the ranch was also a lot of work. So it wasn't all awesome. Some of it was work. And then my kids wanted to go up there and help grandma and grandpa with the harvest. And it was like them for driving tractor and sitting on a trailer. But for me, it's hot, dusty, dirty work. So I'm like, yeah, I'm glad. So everything's always mixed for me.
Okay.
But the memories you always take with you. I think, you know, I've got a friend that says memories make us rich, and they do. And you take the good memories on and then you make new memories. We had our first family dinner at the house last night. First dinner anybody else came to our house for. And
really?
A Father's Day deal, and cooked some prime rib that my son-in-law was ready to kill for. He was like, how did you make this? And when I told him, he goes, oh my gosh, I shouldn't have eaten it. And then when he was leaving, he goes, we got to do this again. It makes the sweetest prime rib roast ever. It's just fabulous. But in any case, so we're making new memories here. We had two people here yesterday. We're going, I want to live here, which is really kind of fun. So it's a special place. I mean, Sarah has made it a special place, and our contracting people. And so, yeah, it's pretty exciting that we're making new memories here. So I, when we sell things, I think both Sarah and I let them go pretty easily. I know the last house we sold here in Newbury Park, the owners that bought it may have bought too much house for themselves. So Lewis is still caring for that property. They hired him to care for that. And so he says, yeah, they've had some problems with stuff and damage to stuff. And some of the stuff we had there, we really enjoyed. They don't enjoy so much. And Sarah's like, I said, is that bother you here? Sarah's, no, my gosh, when I left it, I left it. So I guess you probably will. I got young daughters there. I was trying to think, it was the first time we moved when our kids were young, and we had probably about the same age you did. We had a 6-year-old, no, older. We had a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old, and we moved from the home they were growing up in at that point to a home that we were more in until they got out of high school.
Okay.
Same town, though, just different place. And basically, to move because we needed some space for Sarah's parents to live with us because they were hurting and needed some space. So,
okay. Yeah, it's interesting. I think for us, like I know the duplex that Jess and I rented were the first few years of our marriage. There was a lot of fun memories in that, but it was also like, okay, we're good. You know, it's a rental. We're letting it go. We're getting out of here kind of a thing.
Then you lived in a dorm and you're ready to leave that.
we were very thankful. Jess especially was like, man, let's get out of here. There was no hesitation at all. Yep. When she was given the opportunity to leave a 2-bedroom, 1-bathroom apartment in a dorm room.
Yeah, no kidding. So you're moving off to Sheridan, Wyoming, and a new job with a college. And
yeah, prepping for a new season of life in that regard. Still going to be doing some still be having some life coaching clients and do some of the consulting stuff that I'm doing, hoping to be able to do some marital couples retreats in the summer. Yep. There's been a couple of individuals we've been talking to that are really interested in that and have already been doing marital coaching for quite a while. Lots of dialogue. Those are in its very initial stages as far as dialogue goes around along that. But yep. I know there's been a lot of just feedback that I've gotten from community and also from live stream community of people that would love to be able to have access points to conversation on what does it look like to argue well? What does it look like to hold space for each other? What does it look like to not view the other person as the villain, especially when you're navigating trauma or you're navigating the baggage that you brought into the marriage? How do you not take that baggage and stuff it over the neck of the person that you said I do to? So I know there's been a lot of interest there. I don't know exactly what that'll look like as we are making that transition up to Sheridan, but yep. There's a lot of hope, a lot of excitement. There's a lot of opportunity for Jess to do some of the event planning, event coordinating, wedding stuff that she loves doing. Cool. So there's some cool connections up there. So yeah, it's going to be very bittersweet. There's a lot of excitement, but then we're also leaving some incredibly rich community and family here in the Torrington area. So yeah, it's going to be a very mixed bag.
I've got the 22 unspoken rules that actually make a marriage work.
Ooh, okay.
And this is from BuzzFeed. So
there's some interesting. All right.
And it's according to couples who have been together for two decades or more. So
okay.
But we don't have to cover it today. I just think you brought marriage interesting. So maybe someday we'll tackle it. Maybe today. I don't know.
Well, what do you want to explore a few of those? I'm intrigued now.
It's 22, man. Once we get started, it'll be the show.
All right, let's roll it. Let's
see. You wanna go with that? Yeah. You want a best thing you heard this week before we get there?
Yeah, actually, I had.
I like the way you look into space. Like, I don't know. Best thing.
Actually, I gotta grab my notebook here.
Again with that. Again, unprepared.
I know. Kyle,
what's up with that? You can't even find your phone, can you?
Well, no, I can't find my notebook that I had my best thing written down in. That's really sad. No, I was in a conversation with a friend, and we were talking about. We were talking about the idea of being a hero, just the idea that there are very meaningful people who want to be able to help, that want to be able to step in with people that are in need. My supervisor and I were in a conversation together, and she made the comment, Kyle, do you know what heroes do? And I just kind of looked at her and I was like, what are you talking about? And she's like, heroes, they fight valiantly and they die quickly. And I just kind of paused and I was like, well, what are you talking about with that? And she went on to talk about how when we go to rescue people or try to save people out of our own need or out of this place to try to fulfill ourselves, that often we may try to save somebody who doesn't necessarily want to be saved, or we may try to rescue somebody in a way that we feel like they need to be rescued, but they don't necessarily feel like that's the way they need to be rescued. And the quote that came up in the midst of that was, the heart of a genuine warrior is a person who knows where their soul goes. And that was a really intriguing.
Okay, now I'm confused. The quote was about heroes. Now we're to warriors. And now I'm confused. What happened?
Yeah, well, so the idea of the warrior.
You got to find your notebook, man. It must make more sense in there.
So the idea of the warrior was this idea of somebody who fights, and we were talking about the comparison between a warrior and a hero. My mind, when I think of a warrior, I also think of somebody who's a hero that goes in and is trying to fight for somebody that's trying to rescue someone. And so when they talked about the warrior and how a warrior is somebody who knows where their soul goes, that was a really intriguing idea to me. That there's somebody who is not fighting out of a space of need. They're not somebody who's fighting out of a space of, well, I have some gap in my own self that I need to fill by meeting this meaningful connection in somebody else's place, but that I want to come alongside of people. I want to try to help people. I want to try to fight for people in a way that is meaningful or intentional to them, and starting in that curious space. So that's, I know it's kind of a convoluted, but that was the conversation and the context for it.
Yeah, I'm so confused. I'm going to go take a nap, I think.
Sorry, I made you have a mental runaround.
Well, you were talking. I remember when I had some CERT training, which is a certified emergency response team person for the community I live in, so I can help with stuff. they always tell you, make sure you're safe first, you know, particularly in drowning kinds of things. If you go to try and rescue somebody who's drowning, it's most likely that two of you will drown if they're not cooperative. You know, if they want to be rescued their way and their way is not safe, but they're panicked, they don't know what to do. Oftentimes the person doing the rescuing gets killed. That's about how we say a hero dies quickly. It can happen. It can happen with the best of intentions.
And I thought that was it's not that the intentions are bad, but it's what happens to your heart when you try to jump in and do something, especially when it's well-intended, but it's not moving out of a space of curiosity or discovery, or I want to just come alongside of you and help you in this journey. It's I see you flailing in the water and I'm going to come and grab you and rescue you. You know, I did a little bit of swift water emergency rescue training. So this basically, how do you save somebody who is swimming a rapid? How do you rescue them? And 9 times out of 10, they talk about how you actually, if the person is fighting you, you actually knock them unconscious. Like you hit them hard enough to where it stuns them to where they stop fighting you, and then you can rescue them. But you literally have to knock some of them unconscious in order to get them to be able to get them out of the water.
Sarah had that from a doctor too, was telling her, because some of the stress, her parents were both terminally ill and living with us, and her mom was terminally ill because of some things. She denied her own health trying to care for him, so she ends up costing her life. And the doctor said to her, look, this disease is already going to kill 2 people. Don't make it 3. Talking about her.
Whew.
Yeah. And Sarah had a chance to use that last week with someone else that's kind of stripped to the core, trying to help their aging mother, and just said, you know what? Don't let this kill 2 people. You've got to manage what you can give and what you can't give, and manage it well and have a sense of it and make sure. And because we could tell she was exhausted all the time, just wiped out. And you can't live that way. And it seems rude sometimes, but sometimes you got to make that difficult call.
How do you recognize that you're doing that in a loving way? Because I know I hear all the time from people that are wanting to help or that are serving, who are martyring themselves for the sake of others. Their feedback is, well, if I take care of myself, that's just selfish. Or if I'm only looking out for myself, I'm so self-centered. So how do you delineate between walking in love to where you're protecting yourself in a loving way, you're creating loving boundaries, versus just being self-centered and selfish and not looking out for the needs or the cares of others?
One of the things we got to get past is that self-care is selfish. That self-compassion is selfish. I mean, that's really, I mean, Jesus, other yourselves, joy. And the whole way Christians interpret that as an acronym is always your last. So whatever anybody wants of you, you give it to them, you give it to you, give them. And people who manipulate others, they live on that. And particularly elderly parents from that generation can be incredibly manipulative because they're terrified. Death's coming. They want everything in a certain way. And when the kids try to serve that, it's just too much. I like what you said about the warrior knows where his soul is. Is that what you said? Something like that.
Yep.
You got to know where your soul is. Otherwise, you're going to end up caring for people out of your own need not to be perceived as selfish, your own need to do something heroic to make your life meaningful. There's lots of bad motives in caring for people who need care. And you can't set good boundaries while you're being motivated out of something less than, I love you. I'm going to do as much as I can for you. I realize when I push my sleep boundaries, strength boundaries, I mean, you can do things on the extreme for a week or so. And I remember we did that on the farm when we had to get the crop in and rain was coming and we would work till midnight, 1 in the morning. You can do that when you need to for a day or two. Yeah. You can't live an emergency for 3, 4, 5 days, 6, 7, 8 weeks. You can't. You've got to be able to manage it as much as you can, invite other resources alongside and not try and do it all yourself. But what's the rule for that? There isn't one. You just got to have a sensitivity to, okay, this is too far. Now I need to look for other alternatives. And if I can't see them, get an older brother or sister, and I don't mean in age, but just older to come alongside and say, yeah, that's too much. Yeah, here's some other alternatives. And that's important. If we don't do that, hurt ourselves trying to hurt someone else. As Sarah's doctor said, let this disease take 2 or 3 people instead of 2.
So how did you know with Sarah what you had the capacity for?
What I had the capacity for?
So you and Sarah, you go through the situation, right? So Sarah Sarah Louise, we've talked a lot about that, but how did you know what you had the capacity for in walking with Sarah, if she was willing to come back, holding space for her heart? How did you know, or how did you recognize what you had the capacity for and what you didn't have the capacity for?
I think the only way you know is when you reach it. Mm. I mean, how do you, I don't know what capacity I had to wait for Sarah. I can tell you, 5 weeks wasn't too long. Yeah. I never reached a wall of like, I can't do this any longer. I mean, I was gearing myself up. If it's 2 or 3 years, I'm going to hold space. I'm going to do this. So for me, that was easy. I never got to the point where I can't do this. I can't do this a day longer. I can't do it. I can't. Capacity, I think you just have to be aware. What is this costing me physically, emotionally, mentally?
Yeah.
I've always had an intuitive sense, a good sense of I can do this, I can't do that. Particularly with toxic people who want to destroy you and the guise of loving you with Jesus. I have a good threshold to go, yeah, this is not the way a real friendship works. I have no other friendships on the planet like the way you're treating me. And just because your family doesn't give you a pass. We had a couple in our home last Thursday night, couple I just have met very, very recently. Guy, I sensed one of those moments of spend some time with this guy, find out their marriage is crashing. I got two people over here in our home treating each other as rudely as I've ever seen somebody treat somebody else. And I just said, whoa, no, not in my home. We don't do this. Find a way to say it calmly or don't say it. And then the thing that really hit home with them, I heard later, I said, I'm going to tell you what I tell every couple I've ever married. And I turned to him and said, before that woman is ever your wife, she's the beloved daughter of a gracious father. And if you don't treat her that way first, somehow when we marry, we feel like we own the person. And I turned to her and I said, before this man is ever your husband, he's the beloved son of a gracious father. And they were about at half an inch from crossing the contempt line when we met with them. I mean, respect was already destroyed. And I asked them, I said, are you guys holding each other in contempt? And they both had to stop a little bit and go, almost there. And that changed everything. This is the beloved child of a gracious father. You're not treating her. You're not treating him like that. And if you don't, and they're all worried about how I'm being treated. I love watching God open people's eyes at times like that, because we're at our extremity, I think oftentimes emotionally, because somebody's taking advantage of us. And I know with Sarah's parents being with us, God bless them. They went through some very tough stuff. They start taking their depression out on Sarah. And then Sarah's never going to sit down with them and say, you can't do this. But her husband, he has no problem saying, look, you're in my home. We love that you're here. We're trying to care for you best we can. You cannot treat Sarah like a servant. She's your daughter. Now, if we can find a way back to that, great. If we can't find a way back to that, we're going to find another place for you to live. And I don't mind having that kind of hard conversation. That does get you killed. The other side of the word thing. I've realized how few people really regard and respect truth. They just don't. Mm. They have lied their way out of everything their whole life. And when truth, and even relaxed truth, I'm not trying to ram this down your throat. If you don't like it, I'm willing to step back. I'm not willing to let you treat me like this. And if you are, then we're done. And I'll wait till you throttle down. I used to do that with my daughter. She would want to talk about something else. She's like young high school, so early teens. And she'd start because hyperventilating, ranting. It was something we were telling her she couldn't do, she really wanted to do. And I just would say, stop, sweetheart. Mom and I love you. And I'm happy to talk about this with you. And if we made the wrong decision, we're really happy to reconsider it and make a different one. But you need to talk to me the same way I'm talking to you. And I think, why don't you just go up to your room and kind of throttle it down. And when you can come back and have a conversation. And then she'd come back down. She'd be very calm. She'd sit down. And as soon as she'd start defending her case, she'd start ramping up again. Whoa, we just crossed the line. She goes, what? I said, yeah, we can't talk like this. We can't talk from disrespect. So back up to your room. Do whatever you need to do. We talk about this in a day or two. We don't talk about it right now. But when you want to talk about it, we'll talk about. And then when she comes back calmly, and then we're trying to make her decision as best we can because we want to honor what she's done. So She really wanted to go out on a night. We'd planned a family night, and she'd missed a number of family nights. So it was like, this one's really important. I want you to be there. So she does a big party her friends planned, and she just died. I said, okay, if we let you, when she finally got calm enough to talk about it, I said, okay, if we let you go to this party Friday night, what are you giving the family back? What can you give us that would make up for the fact that we had this thing planned and now we're moving it? So when are you going to be available? And then she had some ideas and it worked out great. But you got to have those difficult conversations. And most people hate that. They just do.
Yeah, I find that in general, we're not great as a society, at least in Western American culture, in having tough conversations.
Nope.
Pressing into those and genuinely honoring the humanity of the other person and knowing that on the other side of this, if we can work through this, that's where a whole nother context of relational foundation and resiliency comes, because it hasn't, like that quote that I used a few weeks ago, where it's only a friendship when it's convenient, you know, it's like, whoa, like that is not okay. You know, it's that that's an airy friendship that's built on a house of sand, you know, that's going to fall apart when it actually gets real or the storm comes.
Yeah,
it just. And I feel like as we kind of navigate through that as a society, I think we're moving in even a more challenging space, because now people don't even know how to have a conversation to begin with, let alone a difficult conversation or a hard conversation.
Yeah. And look at what our politics have gone to. We cannot respect someone we disagree with.
Yeah.
And I think that's the easiest thing to do. Okay. I see this differently than you do. How do we negotiate the fact that we see it differently? And they're still trying to, no, but you're wrong and I'm right. And I'm going, look, I'm saying your perspective is valid. I'm also saying I don't share it. So how do we work with that? And it's the people, amazingly, who can't work with that. One of the best things I heard in the last few weeks that I've been had on my list, it wasn't one I was going to share today, but I'll get to it. Thomas Sowell, who's a political commentator, say, when you want to help people, you tell them the truth. When you want to help yourself, you tell them what they want to hear. Isn't that powerful?
That's so good.
When you want to help people, you tell them the truth, even if it's painful and hard. Yeah. And you do it in an incredibly kind and tender way. So the truth has a chance to find a lodging somewhere, right? And when you want to help yourself, you tell them what they want to hear, which politically, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But I would say interpersonally, I would change this quote a little bit. When you want to help people, you tell them the truth. When you want to help yourself, you tell them what you want them to hear. And that often involves an incredible amount of duplicity. Instead of being liar, liar, pants on fire, let's just say duplicity. Because I'm telling you what I want you to know to manipulate the response I want. And I'll be honest, it shocks me. Someone called me today and we got into a conversation about the Shaq lawsuit. And I said, to be honest, it always, to this day, it shocks me that people would rather live a lie and force a lie to get what to get their way, to get what they want, rather than simply, let's be honest, let's be truthful. And if you want to change something we've done, let's change it. I've got the freedom to change anything. And I'm willing to go a long way to help you be happy. But when you start with a lie, and even in that whole thing, when our lawyer wrote up our response to the lawsuit, Brad and I looked at it and went, oh my gosh, there's nothing in here that's true. He's exaggerated everything out of proportion. And so, and then I'm signing it under penalty of perjury. And I'm sorry, that means something to me. It may not mean something to some of our political leaders who sign stuff and they, oh, well, I didn't really mean that. No big deal. And it's significant. When people say, it's no big deal. So he managed some financial affairs and signed things that weren't true. It is a big deal. Everything I've signed with my name. Brian and I called the guy and said, we can't sign that. Why not? I said, because you're taking everything and exaggerated it. And he goes, is the other side lying? And I said, well, of course they are. He goes, then you've got to lie too. You got to match lie for lie to win legally. And we went, not going to do it. No, and it cost us. It does cost us. And it, interpersonally, when you're being lied to and you don't join the lie, eventually you get called a liar by people who, you know, you're lying. Actually, I'm the only one in this room telling you the truth. I've been telling you the truth since this started. You liar. You liar. You always lie about everything. I just go, oh my gosh. See, then there's no way. That's contempt right there.
Yeah.
There's no way to progress that forward. I'd love to progress it forward. It's people I care about. But once lying becomes the economy of the realm and you're not willing to join it, mm-hmm. then you get into this kind of thing. People will tell you what they want you to hear. And particularly when you tell selective things, you manage mm-hmm. and religious leaders are notorious for this. We'll give you just enough information to agree with us, what we want to do here, whether it's some financial thing or protecting somebody who was caught in a scandal, but we want to hide it. We'll tell you just as much as we want you to hear so you can agree with us. This is a lousy way to do relationships. And I think when you live honestly, even with people you're trying to serve, and you just say, I can't go as far as you want me to go, you are really benefiting both of yourselves. Because if they're not willing to listen to what's true, eventually you'll be out of the relationship. You'll be out of helping, which is an answer. Because they're trying to take you under. It may be because of pain and fear and trauma, and it might be all. They're trying to take you under with them. Go as far as you can, but no further. Because you can't let people kill you in the name of, I need help from you. It's hard.
And yet the temptation for it to feel like it's loving to start drowning with them. Jess and I were flying to Michigan just a couple of weeks ago. And it was, so we had one of my daughters was on my lap, and then Eliana, our oldest daughter, she was in the middle seat, and then Jess was on the outside seat. And yet I'm thinking, okay, if the oxygen actually does get released, there's only going to be three oxygen masks here. There's not going to be four. There's going to be three that are going to drop down. So how are we going to navigate this? And, you know, and that was literally going through my head as I've got my one-year-old daughter sitting on my lap. And I'm like, oh, I'm sure they've got an idea of how that's going to work out. But it feels very like the temptation is for it to feel very loving when we're sacrificing or giving ourselves over to somebody. At least it can feel that way. It can feel special, or it can feel meaningful. It can feel loving when they're taking us to the cleaner or when they're dragging us down.
And sometimes it is. In extenuating circumstances, if I have to jump in front of a train to rescue my child, I would do that.
Yeah.
I would do it for Sarah. Would I do it for anybody, everybody on the, I don't know. I try and save my wife if she was drowning. And even if it was risky to me, I would.
Yeah.
The hope would be that one of us would get rescued. That would be I hate to have us both die in that kind of scenario, but I think with interpersonal stuff and emotional pain and personal pain, there's to be a whole lot of Jesus lead me here. Where can I go? And where's too far? And how do I look at other options? I think people in pain, often they put it in, I need you to do this. And if you can't do this, then the option is you don't do anything. And that's not usually the other option. The other option, okay, let's stop a minute. How else can we serve this need without taking other people under around you? And it's really strange, because both Sarah and I have noticed with our parents' generation, there's so much fear in older age that they just, they want everything their way. Those last attempts to try to control everything grows exponentially in that period of time. I'm hoping to die very differently. I like the thing that said the last thing you owe your children is to die well. And don't torment your children on the way out the door. Make it so people don't look forward to you dying. that's my goal.
Yeah.
No, be kind, be gentle. Take an option that isn't your favorite option. You don't have to have everything your way at the end. And if you've lived your whole life that way, that's how you want it. And if you've learned to lay down your life for others early on, then obviously you're going to lay them down for your kids. I don't want to. We had some things with both my parents where Sarah and I really held some burdens greater than we probably needed to because of their fears and their inability to handle pain later stages of life with grace and with kindness. Now, we always tried to teach them because you want my help. You're not going to beat up on my wife. You're just not going to because that's not going to work real well.
What does that look like in a marital relationship when you're trying to navigate that? You know, we talked a little bit last week about as long as it takes. Yeah. And yet, how do you know, or what does that process look like as you're seeking Father's nudge or his inclination or his wisdom in that for as long as it takes or as long as I have the capacity for? Because I've been thinking about as long as it takes, and my heart in a lot of regards leaps at that and says, I would hope like if I'm if I'm walking through something with Jess, I would say as long as it takes for God to work this out in her life or vice versa in my life, mm-hmm. I'm willing to walk through that and to navigate that with her and to hold space for her in that. And yet, man, it's gotten less black and white for me the longer I've walked with people in really challenging relationships. And so I'd love your kind of feedback or thought on that. Like, and maybe this is a fault of my generation in regards to being, you know, what's going on with your heart and how taking care of yourself and self-care versus no, we're going to endure this marriage or we're going to endure this challenge for as long as it takes for there to be breakthrough. What does it look like to say, Lord, I want to honor, for example, I want to honor my marriage vows. I want to honor the commitment that I made when I stood in front of my friends and family and said, I want to love this person until death do us part. And you made the comment, you know, was there like as long as it takes. Mm-hmm. And yet there's some people that I've been walking with that question is up on the table. And it's like, man, how do I help them sort out what does that look like in a loving way, in a caring way, both to themselves, to the other people that are involved in that relationship? What does that look like?
Yeah, I think the major thing we were talking about is so long as it takes is I'm hanging in there with God for as long as it takes for things to be arranged around my heart. Does that apply directly to I'm in it with this person for as long as it takes? And then the question is always, well, what's going on here?
Yeah,
because a partner, I don't think a legitimate partner in a marriage is not going to say, for instance, realize my trauma is abusive to you, particularly if you're a fighter. I'm going to demean you and beat you up. And the spouse is saying, you know, I'm just going to sit in this as long as it takes. And particularly the abuse is physical. And particularly if you're the woman and you're getting beat up by a husband, it could also go the other way around.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then it's not as long as it takes. It's, you know, there's got to be a, if something I do creates pain for Sarah
mm-hmm.
and I can't fix it, I can't stop it, I can't whatever, then I have to be incredibly aware that I don't want Sarah to be my victim. I just don't. Mm. And I think that goes back to the scripture where Paul writes, God will not allow you to be tempted above what you're able. I know we've always applied that to temptations in the world, blah, blah. I think you're not in a circumstance that's bigger than God's ability to help you manage it. But now how do you manage it? You manage it with God. If God's saying, step away, even from a marriage. A marriage, yes, I'm committed to love you and follow you through life. I am. But if that turns abusive, if that turns, you know, you're not interested in getting help and you're not trying to deal with the fact that your pain, your trauma, particularly if you're a fighter, is beating the crud out of your spouse, take some space. You know, it's not as long as it takes in that framework. But what rises to that? I don't know. I mean, Sarah and I have been married 48 years and there's still things that, you know, there's things, little things we do that drive the other one nuts now and then.
Yeah.
But that's just normal. That's not, that's as long as it takes. I'm not worried about that.
Yeah.
Forgiveness is great. Extend it all you can. I think when things arise to the destruction of the soul of the other person, and that can be physical abuse, there can be other kinds of abuse that does that as well. Now it's, okay, God, I need you to show me. Because there's nothing coming at me which is going to overwhelm me. Jesus promised me a way out. Now, the way out may not be I'm just staying in this marriage and God's going to give me grace no matter what. No, it may be I need to get away from this because that other person, if the marriage is going to work, needs some time to get more whole inside so they're not torturing their partner. And they've got to want that. You can't say, well, I married him. He committed to, so I can beat the crud out of him every week and say, no, you cannot. That's not appropriate in human relationships. That's what I said to this couple the other night. We treat our partners in ways we would treat no one else in the world. And when you're crossing that line, that's a horrible line to cross. And no, the other one doesn't have to take it. It doesn't mean divorce is the answer.
Yeah.
How do we not just ignore it? How do we manage it? And I think people who are abusive, even if it's involuntarily abusive because of trauma, they always just want to start over. Let's forget and just move on. Forget that happened last week. No, we're not going to forget it happened. Because if it happens again, we need to do something different than we did because this was too painful.
Yeah.
And if the other person is not sensitive to that, then it's just, you're my whipping boy and I'm going to use you for that. No, that's not healthy. I would look for what's the alternative. Is it trial? Is it separate? Let's separate for a time. Okay, you decide you want help or not. Because I love you. I want to be with you, but I cannot handle. Now, if you've got a pretty good, strong emotional base, whatever, you might be able to, one person might be able to do longer at that than another person.
Yeah.
And so there are no clear answers. That's why I love the fact that Jesus wants to guide us through this. And
yeah,
I've got to spend the time, be in his presence, talk to older people who might have a sense of what I might see here. But no matter what you're facing, and no matter how badly it hurts, there is a way out. There is a way through it. Mm. God's promised that. And Jesus knows what that is. And we're trying to figure it out on our own, or we make ourselves the victim of circumstance because, well, God never speaks to me. I don't hear him. That's where people just get wiped out. Then you'll get owned. If you're living to Christian virtues without Jesus' power and direction and sensitivity, they will kill you. Christian virtues of themselves, you're going to lay down your life. You're going to always do the right thing as you see it. And it doesn't matter who kills you. You're going to drown with a panicked victim's got their legs wrapped around your head till you both go under. That's what's going to happen. And you've got to just say, I can go as far as I can go. I can't go further. Mm-hmm. And Jesus can show you that. Most of us will get out early. I mean, Jesus is in the garden saying, God, if this cup can pass from me. So was Jesus going beyond his thought limits? Probably. This is going to be a big deal. Is he willing to enlist the Father to get him to go through with that and help him and hold him? And then that extremity will drive us to God. If we have this mentality that there is a way through, I think most people just put their intellect in there. What can I can't? Obviously, I need to get divorced. I need to run out on this thing. Because most of the bad decisions are made with either or choices when there's a lot more options in between.
And I think I really like that idea of finding the way through, right? Because I think sometimes the way through may be separation or maybe getting some space or, you know, whatever that might be, or maybe stepping out from that business relationship or whatever that looks like. I think from my end, though, I look at it and I'm like, okay, but I also am in the process of counseling, especially my high school or my, you know, junior high school clients. Their emotional relational resiliency is almost non-existent. Right. And so their first inclination is to step away, to ditch it, to bail it, to shoot it down, to destroy it. I mean, that's their first inclination instead of, okay, I want to hang in here. This is valuable enough to me that I want to see if there's some alternative ways to work through this, to sort this out, to be able to find a healthy landing space in this relationship. And that's the hard thing that I'm really working with a lot of young people on is what does it look like to build that resiliency and to be able to hang, because at least a lot of my clients, their experience of relationships has been very volatile, has been in some regards very abusive. And so a lot of them don't even have a model of what healthy relationship even looks like to begin with.
Right.
And so they don't know what they're working towards. They don't know that there is, if they press through this or they press into this hard conversation, that there actually might be wealth and joy and richness to be found on the other side of it. Because that's just not a part of their realm. That's not a part of their experience.
Yeah. And that's the other option here, right? It's stay in it and be abused, leave it and be alone. That's how they tend to see it. Yeah. And the other thing, if they don't have the relational resiliency, how do they create the relational resiliency?
Yeah.
How do I get, you know, maybe there's camp someday people can go to and learn relational resiliency or something. I don't know. Because that's a skill for life, right?
Yeah.
To be able to manage myself in relationships, enjoy the good ones, be able to tolerate enough pain and some hard ones to get to the good side of those things.
Yeah.
But if I'm emotionally spent, I don't have the tools, I don't have the experience, then get it. Find somebody who does know that. Find somebody who will walk with you through that, which they're obviously doing with you. So those are the other options. It's not just I have to quit because I can't take it the way it is. And it is to look deeper and to find a resource. That's what I think when Jesus comes to save us, this is what he meant. He didn't mean I'm going to give you get a hell free card.
Yeah.
He meant I have a way to save you in the horrible chaos that this fallen creation throws at you. I have a way to manage it. And if you find me and follow me, I will lead you. And if you don't, then you're left to your own whims and devices over and over and over again. And I think those people get incredibly hurt and incredibly jaded, and they don't know where to go from there. Yeah. My heart goes out to people like that. Well, we got through our 22 unspoken rules of marriage. We didn't even try. I'm kidding.
I was like, did we? Did we touch on them all?
We didn't touch any of them. Not one of them here. So yeah, a couple of them would apply, I guess, but maybe we'll come back to it on another day. I'm glad we've been talking about the last few weeks. Relationships are tough, and the value of them is there. Hands down, the value is there. But so is the destructive potential. It's like breaking the atom, right? Incredible good can come from that, and incredible devastation both. I thought about that. I saw this t-shirt the week after we did the podcast a couple weeks ago about relationships and community and some of that kind of talk. And it was on a t-shirt. It said, I used to be a people person until people ruined that for me.
Used to be a people person until I encountered people, and then it was out the window.
And yet my story is very much the opposite of that. I used not to be a people person. And then Jesus won me into really caring about people and loving them, and not just about sermons and books and things that don't deal with people. But man, I spend so much of my time now with people that I take great joy in. It's really amazing to be able to help someone see something they haven't been able to see. And this couple that was over last week, to leave our home in very different space from when they walked in. Everything had come way, way down the meter. And yet we're not done. I mean, that it was just kind of cooling the temperature. And now how do we build the framework so we don't climb up that ladder again? Because they will. If you don't have some skills not to, you will go up that ladder again. And same's true in our own life. If we're being manipulated by people, and we might get a respite and come off that wall, but you're going to climb that wall again. If there's not something better, respect, insight, self-care inside. That knows what I can and can't do, knows where the lines are, and is willing to be as giving and as selfless as God invites me to be, but not drown trying to save a drowning victim, because that does nobody any good.
I deeply appreciate that. I think about just the spaces that so many people are in that I talk with in that regard, and in the idea of relationship and wanting so desperately to find healthy relationships. And man, it's like, you know, there's just like this deep heart lament, honestly, of like, God, why does it feel like the deck has been stacked against them? You know, like to be able to have that kind of connection and to have community, to be able to step into a spirit-filled life. And yet it's like, Lord, why does it feel like the deck has been allowed to be stacked against them? You know, and I know that, like, we have a God that is able to take 300 and send them against an epic army, and like numbers don't make sense and our world logic doesn't make sense. But I see some of these people, and especially some of my young people that I work with, and it's like, man, Father, the deck feels like it was stacked against them being able to experience a wholehearted life at the day they landed on this planet, and they've been trying to fight against that.
And it's okay to say it was. I know people. I mean, the deck was stacked pretty good for me. Loving parents, wholesome neighborhood, not great need, no trauma as far as I know. I mean, I got some wonderful cards dealt me.
Yeah.
The idea that God did the dealing, though, is the thing. Just to say, you know, the brokenness of creation does influence us disproportionately. And those of us that have had better, I'll call the word privilege. I know it's a loaded word these days, but those of us who've had better privilege owe it to those who do not have better privilege to use what we have, to use the extra resources we have, not for our amusement and relaxing, but to help others who need that leg up, who need a way through the dark stuff. And to me, that's the core to the Christian mission.
Yeah.
It's whatever resource I have, whatever extra I have, particularly if I have been blessed by God, it was to be a blessing in the world, as Israel proceeded. We are blessed by God to be the chosen people and do whatever we want. And the rest of you are all pagans and heathens, and who cares? And it behooves us who follow Christ who have had great privilege in our growing up and experience. We've had good cards dealt to us to share our cards with other people.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.